Thursday, March 22, 1906. Susie's biography, Langdon's illness and death. Susie tells of interesting men whom her father met in England and Scotland. Dr. John Brown, Mr. Charles Kingsley, Mr. Henry M. Stanley, Sir Thomas Hardy, Mr. Henry Irving, Robert Browning, Sir Charles Dilke, Charles Reed, William Black, Lord Houghton, Frank Buckland, Tom Hughes, Anthony Trollope, Tom Hood, Dr. MacDonald, and Harrison Ainsworth. Mr. Clemens tells of meeting Lewis Carroll, of luncheon at Lord Houghton's, letters from Mr. and Mrs. Clemens to Dr. Brown. Mr. Clemens's regret that he did not take Mrs. Clemens for last visit to Dr. Brown. From Susie's biography, I stopped in the middle of Mama's early history to tell you about our trip to Vassar because I was afraid I would forget about it. Now I will go on where I left off. Sometime after Miss Emma Nye died, Papa took Mama and little Langdon to Elmira for the summer. When in Elmira, Langdon began to fail, but I think Mama did not know just what was the matter with him. I was the cause of the child's illness. His mother trusted him to my care, and I took him a long drive in an open barouche for an airing. It was a raw, cold morning, but he was well wrapped about with furs, and in the hands of a careful person, no harm would have come to him. But I soon dropped into a reverie and forgot all about my charge. The furs fell away and exposed his bare legs. By and by the coachman noticed this, and I arranged the wraps again, but it was too late. The child was almost frozen. I hurried home with him. I was aghast at what I had done, and I feared the consequences. I have always felt shame for that treacherous morning's work, and have not allowed myself to think of it when I could help it. I doubt if I had the courage to make the confession at that time. I think it most likely that I have never confessed until now. From Susie's biography. At last it was time for Papa to return to Hartford, and Langdon was real sick at that time, but still Mama decided to go with him, thinking the journey might do him good. But after they reached Hartford, he became very sick, and his trouble proved to be diphtheria. He died about a week after Mama and Papa reached Hartford. He was buried by the side of Grandpa at Elmira, New York. Susie rests there with them, SLC. After that, Mama became very, very ill, so ill that there seemed great danger of death, but with a great deal of good care she recovered. Some months afterward, Mama and Papa, and Susie, who was perhaps 14 or 15 months old at the time, SLC, went to Europe and stayed for a time in Scotland and England. In Scotland, Mama and Papa became very well acquainted with Dr. John Brown, the author of Rab and His Friends, and he met, but was not so well acquainted with, Mr. Charles Kingsley, Mr. Henry M. Stanley, Sir Thomas Hardy, grandson of the Captain Hardy, to whom Nelson said, "Kiss me, Hardy," when dying on shipboard, Mr. Henry Irving, Robert Browning, Sir Charles Dilke, Mr. Charles Reed, Mr. William Black, Lord Houghton, Frank Buckland, Mr. Tom Hughes, Anthony Trollope, Tom Hood, son of the poet, and Mama and Papa were quite well acquainted with Dr. MacDonald and family, and Papa met Harrison Ainsworth. I remember all these men very well indeed, except the last one. I do not recall Ainsworth. By my count, Susie mentions 14 men. They are all dead except Sir Charles Dilke and Mr. Tom Hughes. We met a great many other interesting people, among them Lewis Carroll, author of The Immortal Alice, but he was only interesting to look at, for he was the stillest and shyest full-grown man I have ever met except Uncle Remus. Dr. MacDonald and several other lively talkers were present, and the talk went briskly on for a couple of hours, but Carroll sat still all the while except that now and then he answered a question. His answers were brief. I do not remember that he elaborated any of them. At a dinner at Smalley's we met Herbert Spencer. With a large luncheon party at Lord Houghton's, we met Sir Arthur Helps, who was a celebrity of worldwide fame at the time, but is quite forgotten now. Lord Elcho, a large, vigorous man, sat at some distance down the table. He was talking earnestly about Godalming. It was a deep and flowing and unarticulated rumble, but I got the Godalming pretty clearly every time it broke free of the rumble, and as all the strength was on the first end of the word, it startled me every time, because it sounded so like swearing. In the middle of the luncheon, Lady Houghton rose, remarked to the guests on her right and on her left in a matter-of-fact way, "Excuse me, I have an engagement," and without further ceremony she went off to meet it. This would have been doubtful etiquette in America. Lord Houghton told a number of delightful stories. He told them in French, and I lost nothing of them but the nubs. I will insert here one or two of the letters referred to by Jock Brown in the letter which I received from him a day or two ago, and which we copied into yesterday's record. June 22, 1876. Dear Dr. Brown, indeed I was a happy woman to see the familiar handwriting. I do hope that we shall not have to go so long again without a word from you. I wish you could come over to us for a season. It seems as if it would do you good. You and yours would be so very welcome. We are now where we were 2 years ago when Clara, our baby, was born, on the farm on the top of a high hill where my sister spends her summers. The children are grown fat and hearty, feeding chickens and ducks twice a day, and are keenly alive to all the farm interests. Mr. J.T. Fields was with us with his wife a short time ago, and you may be sure we talked most affectionately of you. We do so earnestly desire that you may continue to improve in health. Do let us know of your welfare as often as possible. Love to your sister. Kind regards to your son, please. As ever, affectionately your friend, Livy L. Clemens. 1875. Dear Dr. Brown, we had grown so very anxious about you that it was a great pleasure to see the dear familiar handwriting again, but the contents of the letter did make us inexpressibly sad. We have talked so much since about your coming to see us. Would not the change do you good? Could you not trust yourself with us? We would do everything to make you comfortable and happy that we could, and you have so many admirers in America that would be so happy and proud to welcome you. Is it not possible for you to come? Could not your son bring you? Perhaps the entire change would give you a new and healthier lease of life. Our children are both well and happy. I wish that you could see them. Susie is very motherly to the little one. Mr. Clemens is hard at work on a new book now. He has a new book of sketches recently out, which he is going to send you in a few days. Most of the sketches are old, but some few are new. Oh, Dr. Brown, how can you speak of your life as a wasted one? What you have written has alone done an immense amount of good. And I know, for I speak from experience, that one must get good every time they meet and chat with you. I receive good every time I even think of you. Can a life that produces such an effect on others be a wasted life? I feel while you live the world is sweeter and better. You ask if Clara is queer and wistful and commanding like your Susie. We think she is more queer, more quaint, perhaps more commanding, but not nearly so wistful in her ways as your Susie. The nurse that we had with us in Edinburgh had to leave me to take care of a sister ill with consumption. We have had ever since a quiet ladylike German girl. I must leave a place for Mr. C. Do think about coming to us. Give my love to your sister and your son. Affectionately, Livy L. Clemens. Dear Doctor, if you and your son Jock only would run over here, what a welcome we would give you, and besides, you would forget cares and the troubles that come of them. To forget pain is to be painless, to forget care is to be rid of it, to go abroad is to accomplish both. Do try the prescription. Always with love, Samuel L. Clemens. P.S. Livy, you haven't signed your letter, don't forget that, S.L.C. P.P.S. I hope you will excuse Mr. Clemens's P.S. to me. It is characteristic for him to put it right on the letter. Livy, L.C. Hartford, June 1st, 1882. My dear Mr. Brown, I was 3,000 miles from home at breakfast in New Orleans when the damp morning paper revealed the sorrowful news among the cable dispatches. There was no place in America, however remote or however rich or poor or high or humble, where words of mourning for your honored father were not uttered that morning, for his works had made him known and loved all over the land. To Mrs. Clemens and me, the loss is a personal one, and our grief the grief which one feels for one who is peculiarly near and dear. Mrs. Clemens has never ceased to express regret that we came away from England the last time without going to see him, and often we have since projected a voyage across the Atlantic for the sole purpose of taking him by the hand and looking into his kind eyes once more before he should be called to his rest. We both thank you greatly for the Edinburgh papers which you sent. My wife and I join in affectionate remembrances and greetings to yourself and your aunt, and in the sincere tender of our sympathies. Faithfully yours, S. L. Clemens. P.S. Our Susie is still Megalopis. He gave her that name. Can you spare us a photograph of your father? We have none but the one taken in group with ourselves. It was my fault that she never saw Dr. John in life again. How many crimes I committed against that gentle and patient and forgiving spirit. I always told her that if she died first, the rest of my life would be made up of self-reproaches for the tears I had made her shed. And she always replied that if I should pass from life first, she would never have to reproach herself without having loved me the less devotedly or the less constantly because of those tears. We had this conversation again and for the thousandth time when the night of death was closing about her, though we did not suspect that. In the letter last quoted above, I say, Mrs. Clemens has never ceased to express regret that we came away from England the last time without going to see him. I think that that was intended to convey the impression that she was a party concerned in our leaving England without going to see him. It is not so. She urged me, she begged me, she implored me to take her to Edinburgh to see Dr. John, but I was in one of my devil moods, and I would not do it. I would not do it because I should have been obliged to continue the courier in service until we got back to Liverpool. It seemed to me that I had endured him as long as I could. I wanted to get aboard ship and be done with him. How childish it all seems now, and how brutal, that I could not be moved to confer upon my wife a precious and lasting joy, because it would cause me a small inconvenience. I have known few meaner men than I am. By good fortune, this feature of my nature does not often get to the surface, and so I doubt if any member of my family except my wife ever suspected how much of that feature there was in me. I suppose it never failed to arrive at the surface when there was opportunity. But it was as I have said. The opportunities have been so infrequent that this worst detail of my character has never been known to any but two persons, Mrs. Clemens, who suffered from it, and I, who suffer from the remembrance of the tears it caused her. Friday, March 23rd, 1906. Some curious letter superscriptions which have come to Mr. Clemens. Our inefficient postal system under Postmaster General Key. Reminiscences of Mrs. Harriet Beecher Stowe. Story of Reverend Charlie Stowe's little boy. A good many years ago, Mrs. Clemens used to keep as curiosities some of the odd and strange superscriptions that decorated letters that came to me from strangers in out-of-the-way corners of the earth. One of these superscriptions was the work of Dr. John Brown, and the letter must have been the first one he wrote me after we came home from Europe in August or September 74. Evidently, the doctor was guessing at our address from memory, for he made an amusing mess of it. The superscription was as follows. Mr. S. L. Clemens, parenthesis, Mark Twain, close parenthesis, Hartford, New York, near Boston, USA. Now then comes a fact which is almost incredible, to wit. The New York Post Office, which did not contain a single salaried idiot who could not have stated promptly who the letter was for and to what town it should go, actually sent that letter to a wee little hamlet hidden away in the remoteness of the vast state of New York. For what reason? Because that lost and never previously heard of hamlet was named Hartford. The letter was returned to the New York Post Office from that hamlet. It was returned innocent of the suggestion, try Hartford, Connecticut, although the hamlet's postmaster knew quite well that that was the Hartford the writer of the letter was seeking. Then the New York Post Office opened the envelope, got Dr. John's address out of it, then enclosed it in a fresh envelope and sent it back to Edinburgh. Dr. John then got my address from Menzies, the publisher, and sent the letter to me again. He also enclosed the former envelope, the one that had had the adventures, and his anger at our postal system was like the fury of an angel. He came the nearest to being bitter and defensive that ever he came in his life, I suppose. He said that in Great Britain it was the postal department's boast that by no ingenuity could a man so disguise and conceal a Smith or a Jones or a Robinson in a letter address that the department couldn't find that man. Whereas, then he let fly at our system, which was apparently designed to defeat a letter's attempts to get to its destination when humanly possible. Dr. John was right about our department at that time, but that time did not last long. I think Postmaster General Key was in office then. He was a new broom, and he did some astonishing sweeping for a while. He made some cast-iron rules which worked great havoc with the nation's correspondence. It did not occur to him, rational things seldom occurred to him, that there were several millions of people among us who seldom wrote letters, who were utterly ignorant of postal rules, and who were quite sure to make blunders in writing letter addresses whenever blunders were possible, and that it was the government's business to do the very best it could by the letters of these innocents and help them get to their destinations, instead of inventing ways to block the road. Key suddenly issued some boiler iron rules. One of them was that a letter must go to the place named on the envelope, and the effort to find its man must stop there. He must not be searched for. If he wasn't at the place indicated, the letter must be returned to the sender. In the case of Dr. John's letter, the post office had a wide discretion. Not so very wide, either. It must go to a Hartford. That Hartford must be near Boston. It must also be in the state of New York. It went to the Hartford that was furthest from Boston, but it filled the requirement of being in the state of New York, and it got defeated. Another rule instituted by Key was that letter superscriptions could not end with Philadelphia, or Chicago, or San Francisco, or Boston, or New York, but in every case must add the state, or go to the dead letter office. Also, you could not say New York, comma, N period Y period. You must add the word city to the first New York, or the letter must go to the dead letter office. During the first 30 days of the dominion of this singular rule, 1,600,000 tons of letters went to the dead letter office from the New York post office alone. The dead letter office could not contain them, and they had to be stacked up outside the building. There was not room outside the building inside the city, so they were formed into a rampart around the city. And if they had had it there during the Civil War, we should not have had so much trouble and uneasiness about an invasion of Washington by the Confederate armies. They could neither have climbed over nor under that breastwork, nor bored nor blasted through it. Mr. Key was soon brought to a more rational frame of mind. Then a letter arrived for me enclosed in a fresh envelope. It was from a village priest in Bohemia or Galicia, and was boldly addressed, Mark Twain, Somewhere. It had traveled over several European cities. It had met with hospitality and with every possible assistance during its wide journey. It was ringed all over on both sides with a chainmail mesh of postmarks. There were 19 of them altogether, and one of them was a New York postmark. The postal hospitalities had ceased at New York, within 3.5 hours of my home. There the letter had been opened, the priest's address ascertained, and the letter had then been returned to him, as in the case of Dr. John Brown. Among Mrs. Clemens's collection of odd addresses was one on a letter from Australia, worded thus, Mark Twain, God Knows Where. That superscription was noted by newspapers, here and there and yonder, while it was on its travels, and doubtless suggested another odd superscription invented by some stranger in a far-off land, and this was the wording of it. Mark Twain, Somewhere. Try Satan. That stranger's trust was not misplaced. Satan courteously sent it along. This morning's mail brings another of these novelties. It comes from France, from a young English girl, and is addressed, Mark Twain, care of President Roosevelt, the White House, Washington, America, USA. It was not delayed, but came straight along bearing the Washington postmark of yesterday. In a diary which Mrs. Clemens kept for a little while, a great many years ago, I find various mentions of Mrs. Harriet Beecher Stowe, who was a near neighbor of ours in Hartford, with no fences between. And in those days she made as much use of our grounds as of her own, in pleasant weather. Her mind had decayed, and she was a pathetic figure. She wandered about all the day long in the care of a muscular Irish woman. Among the colonists of our neighborhood, the doors always stood open in pleasant weather. Mrs. Stowe entered them at her own free will, and as she was always softly slippered and generally full of animal spirits, she was able to deal in surprises, and she liked to do it. She would slip up behind a person who was deep in dreams and musing and fetch a war whoop that would jump that person out of his clothes. And she had other moods. Sometimes we would hear gentle music in the drawing room, and would find her there at the piano, singing ancient and melancholy songs with infinitely touching effect. Her husband, old Professor Stowe, was a picturesque figure. He wore a broad slouch hat. He was a large man and solemn. His beard was white and thick and hung far down on his breast. His nose was enlarged and broken up by a disease which made it look like a cauliflower. The first time our little Susie ever saw him, she encountered him on the street near our house and came flying wide-eyed to her mother and said, "Santa Claus has got loose." Which reminds me of Reverend Charlie Stowe's little boy, a little boy of 7 years. I met Reverend Charlie crossing his mother's grounds one morning, and he told me this little tale. He had been out to Chicago to attend a convention of congregational clergymen, and had taken his little boy with him. During the trip, he reminded the little chap, every now and then, that he must be on his very best behavior there in Chicago. He said, "We shall be the guests of a clergyman. There will be other guests, clergymen and their wives, and you must be careful to let those people see by your walk and conversation that you are of a godly household. Be very careful about this." The admonition bore fruit. At the first breakfast which they ate in the Chicago clergyman's house, he heard his little son say in the meekest and most reverent way to the lady opposite him, "Please, won't you, for Christ's sake, pass the butter?" Monday, March 26th, 1906. John D.'s Bible class again. Mr. Clemens comments on several newspaper clippings, tells Mr. Howells the scheme of this autobiography, tells the newspaper account of a girl who tried to commit suicide, newspapers in remote villages and in great cities contrasted, remarks about Captain E.L. Marsh and Dick Higham, Higbee's letter, and Herald letter to Higbee. Rockefeller Jr. on wealth. Not to be put before God, but all right as a goal for the ambitious. John D. Rockefeller Jr. apologized yesterday to the members of his Bible class for having monopolized all the time of the Sunday hour heretofore, and promised never to do so again, unless his subject should be such that discussion of it would not be practical. "It is better," he said, "that we have a general discussion, and as many of us as possible express our views." Then Mr. Rockefeller raised a question calculated to give the members opportunity for discussion. He took up the Ten Commandments, and after dividing them into the first five as relating to man's obligations to God, and the second five as relating to man's obligation to his neighbor, he said, "We are so in the habit of following and obeying most of the commandments that it is useless to take them up. Let us take the first and fourth commandments. Let us now consider the first commandment, and see if we worship only one God. Many of us give our first thought to our pleasures, and it is very frequently the case today that our first thought is for worldly possessions. A stranger coming here would say that the God of New York was the God of wealth. When we think of pleasure or of wealth before we think of God, then we violate the first commandment. I do not mean to say that we should not be moved by ambition or be given to innocent pleasure, but I mean to say that when we put God second to these aims, we are then not worshiping Him as we should. When the rich young man was told to go and give all his possessions to the poor, it was because Christ realized that the rich young man was thinking first of his wealth and then of God, and violating the first commandment. In the consideration of the fourth commandment, let us try to discover what is the proper way to observe the Sabbath. How far are we justified in violating the restrictions put down in that commandment?" Several discussed Sabbath observance. Then Mr. Rockefeller said, "The subject is one that should give rise to general and helpful discussion. Is it right for me to play golf, to ride a bicycle, or go to the country on Sunday? That is what we want to know. We are here seeking truth. Let us think it over during the week and next Sunday be prepared with our views. Then we may reach a just conclusion." Young John D., you see, has been dripping theology again yesterday. I missed his reunion of the honorary membership of his Bible class last Thursday night, through illness, and I was very sincerely sorry. I had to telephone him not to come for me. However, perhaps it was of profit to me to be obliged to stay away, for I was going to say some things about lying which would have been too nakedly true for Bible class consumption. That Bible class is so uninured to anything resembling either truth or sense that I think a clean, straight truth falling in its midst would make as much havoc as a bombshell. Baby advice in a car. Old man got it, 5-year-old gave it, mother said, "Shut up." A benevolent-looking old man clung to a strap in a crowded Broadway car bound uptown Saturday afternoon. In a corner seat in front of him huddled a weak-looking little woman who clasped a baby to her breast. Beside her sat another child, a girl perhaps 5 years old, who seemed to be attracted by the old man's kindly face, for she gazed at him and the baby with her bright, intelligent eyes opened wide. He smiled at her interest and said to her, "My, what a nice baby! Just such a one as I was looking for. I'm going to take it." "You can't," declared the little girl quickly. "She's my sister." "What? Won't you give her to me?" "No, I won't." "But," he insisted, and there was real wistfulness in his tones, "I haven't a baby in my home." "Then write to God. He'll send you one," said the child confidently. The old man laughed. So did the other passengers, but the mother evidently scented blasphemy. "Tilly," she said, "shut up and behave yourself." That is a scrap which I have cut from this morning's Times. It is very prettily done, charmingly done, done with admirable ease and grace, with the ease and grace that are born of feeling and sympathy, as well as of practice with the pen. Every now and then a newspaper reporter astonishes me with felicities like this. I was a newspaper reporter myself, 44 years ago, and during 3 subsequent years, but as I remember it, I and my comrades never had time to cast our things in a fine literary mold. That scrap will be just as touching and just as beautiful 300 years hence as it is now. I intend that this autobiography shall become a model for all future autobiographies when it is published after my death, and I also intend that it shall be read and admired a good many centuries because of its form and method, a form and method whereby the past and the present are constantly brought face to face, resulting in contrasts which newly fire up the interest all along like contact of flint with steel. Moreover, this autobiography of mine does not select from my life its showy episodes, but deals merely in the common experiences which go to make up the life of the average human being. And the narrative must interest the average human being, because these episodes are of a sort which he is familiar with in his own life, and in which he sees his own life reflected and set down in print. The usual conventional autobiographer seems to particularly hunt out those occasions in his career when he came into contact with celebrated persons, whereas his contacts with the uncelebrated were just as interesting to him, and would be to his reader, and were vastly more numerous than his collisions with the famous. Howells was here yesterday afternoon, and I told him the whole scheme of this autobiography and its apparently systemless system. Only apparently systemless, for it is not that. It is a deliberate system, and the law of the system is that I shall talk about the matter which for the moment interests me, and cast it aside and talk about something else the moment its interest for me is exhausted. It is a system which follows no charted course and is not going to follow any such course. It is a system which is a complete and purposed jumble, a course which begins nowhere, follows no specified route, and can never reach an end while I am alive, for the reason that if I should talk to the stenographer 2 hours a day for 100 years, I should still never be able to set down a tenth part of the things which have interested me in my lifetime. I told Howells that this autobiography of mine would live a couple of 1,000 years without any effort, and would then take a fresh start and live the rest of the time. He said he believed it would, and asked me if I meant to make a library of it. I said that that was my design, but that if I should live long enough, the set of volumes could not be contained merely in a city, it would require a state, and that there would not be any Rockefeller alive, perhaps at any time during its existence, who would be able to buy a full set, except on the installment plan. Howells applauded and was full of praises and endorsement, which was wise in him and judicious. If he had manifested a different spirit, I would have thrown him out of the window. I like criticism, but it must be my way. Day before yesterday, there was another of those happy literary efforts of the reporters, and I meant to cut it out and insert it to be read with a sad pleasure in future centuries, but I forgot and threw the paper away. It was a brief narrative, but well stated. A poor little starved girl of 16, clothed in a single garment in midwinter, albeit, properly speaking, this is spring, was brought in her pendant rags before a magistrate by a policeman, and the charge against her was that she had been found trying to commit suicide. The judge asked her why she was moved to that crime, and she told him, in a low voice broken by sobs, that her life had become a burden which she could no longer bear, that she worked 16 hours a day in a sweatshop, that the meager wage she earned had to go toward the family support, that her parents were never able to give her any clothes or enough to eat, that she had worn this same ruined garment as long back as she could remember, that her poor companions were her envy because often they had a penny to spend for some pretty trifle for themselves, that she could not remember when she had had a penny for such a purpose. The court, the policemen, and the other spectators cried with her, a sufficient proof that she told her pitiful tale convincingly and well. And the fact that I also was moved by it at second hand is proof that that reporter delivered it from his heart through his pen and did his work well. In the remote parts of the country, the weekly village newspaper remains the same curious production it was when I was a boy, 60 years ago, on the banks of the Mississippi. The Metropolitan Daily of the great city tells us every day about the movements of Lieutenant General so-and-so and Rear Admiral so-and-so, and what the Vanderbilts are doing, and what hedge beyond the frontiers of New York John D. Rockefeller is hiding behind to keep from being dragged into court and made to testify about alleged Standard Oil iniquities. These great dailies keep us informed of Mr. Carnegie's movements and sayings. They tell us what President Roosevelt said yesterday and what he is going to do today. They tell us what the children of his family have been saying, just as the princelings of Europe are daily quoted. And we notice that the remarks of the Roosevelt children are distinctly princely, and that the things they say are rather notably inane and not worthwhile. The great dailies kept us overwhelmed, for a matter of 2 months, with a daily and hourly and most minute and faithful account of everything Miss Alice and her fiancé were saying and doing, and what they were going to say and what they were going to do, until at last, through God's mercy, they got married and went under cover and got quiet. Now, the court circular of the remote village newspaper has always dealt, during these 60 years, with the comings and goings and sayings of its local princelings. They have told us during all those years, and they still tell us, what the principal grocery man is doing and how he has bought a new stock. They tell us that relatives are visiting the ice cream man, that Miss Smith has arrived to spend a week with the Joneses, and so on and so on. And all that record is just as intensely interesting to the villagers as is the record I have just been speaking of the doings and sayings of the colossally conspicuous personages of the United States. This shows that human nature is all alike. It shows that we like to know what the big people are doing, so that we can envy them. It shows that the big personage of a village bears the same proportion to the little people of the village that the President of the United States bears to the nation. It shows that conspicuousness is the only thing necessary in a person to command our interest, and in a larger or smaller sense, our worship. We recognize that there are no trivial occurrences in life if we get the right focus on them. In a village, they are just as prodigious as they are when the subject is a personage of national importance. The Swangos, from the Hazel Green, Kentucky Herald. Dr. Bill Swango is able to be in the saddle again. Aunt Rhode Swango visited Joseph Catron and wife Sunday. Mrs. Shiloh Swango attended the auction at Maytown Saturday. W.W. Swango has a nice bunch of cattle ready for the Mount Sterling market. James Murphy bought 10 head of cattle from W.W. Swango last week. Mrs. John Swango of Montgomery County visited Shiloh Swango and family last week. Mrs. Sarah Ellen Swango, wife of Wash, the noted turkey trader of Valeria, was the guest of Mrs. Ben Murphy Saturday and Sunday. Now that is a very genuine and sincere and honest account of what the Swangos have been doing lately in the interior of Kentucky. We see at a glance what a large place that Swango tribe hold in the admiration and worship of the villagers of Hazel Green, Kentucky. In this account, change Swango to Vanderbilt, then change it to Carnegie, next time change it to Rockefeller, next time change it to the President, next time to the mayor of New York, next time to Alice's new husband. Last change of all, change Mrs. Shiloh Swango to Mrs. Alice Roosevelt Longworth. Then it's a court circular, all complete and dignified. Captain E. L. Marsh, former Elmiran who died at Des Moines, Iowa recently. Captain E. L. Marsh, aged 64 years, died at Des Moines, Iowa a week ago Friday, February 23rd, after a long illness. The deceased was born in Enfield, Tompkins County, New York, in 1842, later came to Elmira to live with his parents, and in 1857 left Elmira to locate in Iowa, where he has lived the greater part of the time since, the only exception being brief times of residence in the South and East. He enlisted in Company D of the 2nd Iowa at Des Moines and was elected a captain in that regiment. He served throughout the war with marked courage and efficiency. After the war, Captain Marsh went to New Orleans, where he remained during most of the Reconstruction period, and then went to New York, where he engaged in paving business for several years. He went back to Des Moines in 1877 and resided there during the almost 30 years since. He engaged in the real estate business there with great success. He was married in 1873 and is survived by his wife and two children. Captain Marsh was a member of the Loyal Legion, Commandery of Iowa, and was Senior Vice Commander of the Order for Iowa. He was a member of the GAR also and a member of the Congregational Church. Captain Marsh was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Shepherd Marsh, and Mrs. Marsh was twin sister of the late Mrs. Jervis Langdon of this city. Captain Marsh was a very dear and close friend of his cousin, General Charles J. Langdon of Elmira. This clipping from a Des Moines, Iowa newspaper arrives this morning. Ed Marsh was a cousin of my wife, and I remember him very well. He was present at our wedding 36 years ago, and was a handsome young bachelor. Aside from my interest in him as a cousin of my young bride, he had another interest for me in the fact that in his company of the 2nd Iowa Infantry was Dick Higham. 5 years before the war, Dick, a good-natured, simple-minded, winning lad of 17, was an apprentice in my brother's small printing office in Keokuk, Iowa. He had an old musket, and he used to parade up and down with it in the office, and he said he would rather be a soldier than anything else. The rest of us laughed at him and said he was nothing but a disguised girl, and that if he were confronted by the enemy, he would drop his gun and run. But we were not good prophets. By and by, when President Lincoln called for volunteers, Dick joined the 2nd Iowa Infantry about the time that I was thrown out of my employment as Mississippi River pilot and was preparing to become an imitation soldier on the Confederate side in Ralls County, Missouri. The 2nd Iowa was moved down to the neighborhood of St. Louis and went into camp there. In some way or other, it disgraced itself, and if I remember rightly, the punishment decreed was that it should never unfurl its flag again until it won the privilege by gallantry in battle. When General Grant, by and by, February 62, was ordering the charge upon Fort Donelson, the 2nd Iowa begged for the privilege of leading the assault, and got it. Ed Marsh's company, with Dick in it serving as a private soldier, moved up the hill and through and over the felled trees and other obstructions in the forefront of the charge, and Dick fell with a bullet through the center of his forehead, thus manfully wiping from the slate the chaffing prophecy of 5 or 6 years before. Also, what was left of the 2nd Iowa finished that charge victorious, with its colors flying, and never more to be furled in disgrace. Ed Marsh's sister also was at our wedding. She and her brother bore for each other an almost idolatrous love, and this endured until about a year ago. About the time of our marriage, that sister married a blatherskite by the name of Talmadge Brown. He was a smart man, but unscrupulous and intemperately religious. Through his smartness, he acquired a large fortune, and in his will, made shortly before his death, he appointed Ed Marsh as one of the executors. The estate was worth $1 million or more, but its affairs were in a very confused condition. Ed Marsh and the other one or two executors performed their duty faithfully and without remuneration. It took them years to straighten out the estate's affairs, but they accomplished it. During the succeeding years, all went pleasantly. But at last, about a year ago, some relatives of the late Talmadge Brown persuaded the widow to bring suit against Ed Marsh and his fellow executors for a large sum of money which it was pretended they had either stolen or had wasted by mismanagement. That severed the devoted relationship which had existed between the brother and sister throughout their lives. The mere bringing of the suit broke Ed Marsh's heart, for he was a thoroughly honorable man and could not bear even the breath of suspicion. He took to his bed, and the case went to court. He had no word of blame for his sister and said that no one was to blame but the Browns. They had poisoned her mind. The case was heard in court. Then the judge threw it out with many indignant comments. The Browns rose to leave the courtroom, but he commanded them to wait and hear what else he had to say. Then, in dignified language, he skinned them alive, pronounced them frauds and swindlers, and let them go. But the news of the rehabilitation reached Marsh too late to save him. He did not rally. He had been losing ground gradually for the past 2 months, and now at last the end has come. This morning arrives a letter from my ancient silver mining comrade, Calvin H. Higby, a man whom I have not seen nor had communication with for 44 years. Higby figures in a chapter of mine in Roughing It, where the tale is told of how we discovered a rich blind lead in the Wide West mine in Aurora, or as we called that region then, Esmeralda, and how instead of making our ownership of that exceedingly rich property permanent by doing 10 days' work on it as required by the mining laws, he went off on a wild goose chase to hunt for the mysterious cement mine, and how I went off 9 miles to walk a river to nurse Captain John Nye through a violent case of spasmodic rheumatism, or blind staggers, or some malady of the kind, and how Cal and I came wandering back into Esmeralda one night just in time to be too late to save our fortune from the jumpers. I will insert here this letter, and as it will not see the light until Higby and I are in our graves, I shall allow myself the privilege of copying his punctuation and his spelling. For to me they are a part of the man. He is as honest as the day is long. He is utterly simple-minded and straightforward, and his spelling and his punctuation are as simple and honest as he is himself. He makes no apology for them, and no apology is needed. They plainly state that he is not educated, and they as plainly state that he makes no pretense to being educated. Greenville, Plumas County, California, March 15, 1906. Samuel L. Clemens, New York City, New York. My dear sir, 2 or 3 parties have been after me to write up my recollections of our associations in Nevada in the early 60s and have come to the conclusion to do so and have been jotting down incidents that came to mind for several years. What I am in doubt is the date you came to Aurora, Nevada. Also, the first trip you made over these Sierras to California after coming to Nevada, also as near as passable date, you tended sick man on or near Walker River when our mine was jumped. Don't think for a moment that I intend to steal any of your thunder, but only to mention some instances that you failed to mention in any of your articles, books, etc., that I ever saw. I intend to submit the articles to you so that you can see if anything is objectionable, if so, to erase same and add anything in its place you saw fit. I was burned out a few years since, and all old data went up in smoke is the reason I ask for above dates. Have been sick, more or less, for 2 or 3 years, unable to earn anything to speak of, and the finances are getting pretty low. And I will admit that it is mainly for the purpose of earning a little money that my first attempt at writing will be made. And I should be so pleased to have your candid opinion of its merits, and what, in your wisdom in such matters, would be its value for publication. I enclose a copy of Herald in answer to inquiry I made, if such an article was desired. Hoping to hear from you as soon as convenient, I remain with great respect, yours, etc., C. H. Higby. Copy. New York, March 6th, '06. C. H. Higby, Greenville, California. Dear Sir, I should be glad indeed to receive your account of your experiences with Mark Twain. If they are as interesting as I should imagine they would be, the Herald would be quite willing to pay you very well for them. Of course, it would be impassable for me to set a price on the matter until I had an opportunity of examining it. If you will kindly send it on, with the privilege of our authenticating it through Mr. Clemens, I shall be more than pleased to give you a quick decision and make you an offer as it seems worth to us. However, if you have any particular sum in mind which you think should be the price, I would suggest that you communicate with me to that effect. Yours truly, New York Herald, by George R. Minor, Sunday Editor. I have written Higby and asked him to let me do his literary trading for him. He can shovel sand better than I can, as will appear in the next chapter, but I can beat him all to pieces in the art of fleecing a publisher. Tuesday, March 27, 1906. Higby's spelling, Mr. Clemens's scheme for getting Higby a job at the Pioneer. In 1863, Mr. Clemens goes to Virginia City to be sole reporter on Territorial Enterprise. Mr. Clemens tries his scheme for finding employment for the unemployed on a young St. Louis reporter with great success. Also worked the scheme for his nephew, Mr. Samuel E. Moffat. I have allowed Higbee to assist the Herald man's spelling and make it harmonize with his own. He has done it well and liberally and without prejudice. To my mind, he has improved it, for I have had an aversion to good spelling for 60 years and more, merely for the reason that when I was a boy there was not a thing I could do creditably except spell according to the book. It was a poor and mean distinction, and I early learned to disenjoy it. I suppose that this is because the ability to spell correctly is a talent, not an acquirement. There is some dignity about an acquirement because it is a product of your own labor. It is wages earned, whereas to be able to do a thing merely by the grace of God and not by your own effort transfers the distinction to our heavenly home, where possibly it is a matter of pride and satisfaction, but it leaves you naked and bankrupt. Higbee was the first person to profit by my great and infallible scheme for finding work for the unemployed. I have tried that scheme now and then for 44 years. So far as I am aware, it has always succeeded, and it is one of my high prides that I invented it, and that in basing it upon what I conceived to be a fact of human nature, I estimated that fact of human nature accurately. Higbee and I were living in a cotton domestic lean-to at the base of a mountain. It was very cramped quarters, with barely room for us and the stove. Wretched quarters indeed, for every now and then, between 8 in the morning and 8 in the evening, the thermometer would make an excursion of 50 degrees. We had a silver mining claim under the edge of a hill half a mile away, in partnership with Bob Howland and Horatio Phillips, and we used to go there every morning, carrying with us our luncheon, and remain all day picking and blasting in our shaft, hoping, despairing, hoping again, and gradually but surely running out of funds. At last, when we were clear out and still had struck nothing, we saw that we must find some other way of earning a living. I secured a place in a nearby quartz mill to screen sand with a long-handled shovel. I hate a long-handled shovel. I never could learn to swing it properly. As often as any other way, the sand didn't reach the screen at all, but went over my head and down my back, inside of my clothes. It was the most detestable work I have ever engaged in, but it paid $10 a week and board. And the board was worthwhile because it consisted not only of bacon, beans, coffee, bread, and molasses, but we had stewed dried apples every day in the week, just the same as if it were Sunday. But this palatial life, this gross and luxurious life, had to come to an end, and there were two sufficient reasons for it. On my side, I could not endure the heavy labor, and on the company's side, they did not feel justified in paying me to shovel sand down my back, so I was discharged just at the moment that I was going to resign. If Higbee had taken that job, all would have been well and everybody satisfied, for his great frame would have been competent. He was muscled like a giant. He could handle a long-handled shovel like an emperor, and he could work patiently and contentedly 12 hours on a stretch without ever hastening his pulse or his breath. Meantime, he had found nothing to do and was somewhat discouraged. He said with an outburst of pathetic longing, "If I could only get a job at the Pioneer." I said, "What kind of a job do you want at the Pioneer?" He said, "Why, laborer. They get $5 a day. I said, "If that's all you want, I can arrange it for you." Higbee was astonished. He said, "Do you mean to say that you know the foreman there and could get me a job and yet have never said anything about it?" "No," I said, "I don't know the foreman." "Well," he said, "who is it you know? How is it you can get me the job?" "Why," I said, "that's perfectly simple. If you will do as I tell you to do and don't try to improve on my instructions, you shall have the job before night." He said eagerly, "I'll obey the instructions. I don't care what they are." "Well," I said, "go there and say that you want work as a laborer, that you are tired of being idle, that you are not used to being idle and can't stand it, that you just merely want the refreshment of work and require nothing in return." He said, "Nothing?" I said, "That's it, nothing." "No wages at all?" "Nope. No wages at all." "Not even board?" "No, not even board. You are to work for nothing. Make them understand that you are perfectly willing to work for nothing. When they look at that figure of yours, that foreman will understand that he has drawn a prize. You'll get the job." Higbee said indignantly, "Yes, a hell of a job." I said, "You said you were going to do it, and now you are already criticizing. You have said you would obey my instructions. You are always as good as your word. Clear out now and get the job." He said he would. I was pretty anxious to know what was going to happen, more anxious than I would have wanted him to find out. I preferred to seem entirely confident of the strength of my scheme, and I made good show of that confidence. But really, I was very anxious. Yet I believed that I knew enough of human nature to know that a man like Higby would not be flung out of that place without reflection when he was offering those muscles of his for nothing. The hours dragged along, and he didn't return. I began to feel better and better. I began to accumulate confidence. At sundown, he did at last arrive, and I had the joy of knowing that my invention had been a fine inspiration and was successful. He said the foreman was so astonished at first that he didn't know how to take hold of the proposition, but that he soon recovered and was evidently very glad that he was able to accommodate Higby and furnish him the refreshment he was pining for. Higby said, "How long is this to go on?" I said, "The terms are that you are to stay right there. Do your work just as if you were getting the going wages for it. You are never to make any complaint. You are never to indicate that you would like to have wages or board. This will go on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 days, according to the make of that foreman. Some foremen would break down under the strain in a couple of days. There are others who would last a week. It would be difficult to find one who could stand out a whole fortnight without getting ashamed of himself and offering you wages. Now let's suppose that this is a fortnight foreman. In that case, you will not be there a fortnight, because the men will spread it around that the very ablest laborer in this camp is so fond of work that he is willing and glad to do it without pay. You will be regarded as the latest curiosity. Men will come from the other mills to have a look at you. You could charge admission and get it, but you mustn't do that. Stick to your colors. When the foremen of the other mills cast their eyes upon this bulk of yours and perceive that you are worth 2 ordinary men, they'll offer you half a man's wages. You are not to accept until you report to your foreman. Give him an opportunity to offer you the same. If he doesn't do it, then you are free to take up with that other man's offer. Higby, you'll be foreman of a mine or a mill inside of 3 weeks and at the best wages going." It turned out just so. And after that, I led an easy life with nothing to do, for it did not occur to me to take my own medicine. I didn't want a job as long as Higby had one. One was enough for so small a family, and so during many succeeding weeks I was a gentleman of leisure, with books and newspapers to read, and stewed dried apples every day for dinner the same as Sunday, and I wanted no better career than this in this life. Higby supported me handsomely, never once complained of it, never once suggested that I go out and try for a job at no wages and keep myself. That would be in 1862. I parted from Higby about the end of 62, or possibly it could have been the beginning of 63, and went to Virginia City, for I had been invited to come there and take William H. Wright's place as sole reporter on the Territorial Enterprise and do Wright's work for 3 months while he crossed the plains to Iowa to visit his family. However, I have told all about this in Roughing It. I have never seen Higby since in all these 44 years. Shortly after my marriage in 1870, I received a letter from a young man in St. Louis who was possibly a distant relative of mine. I don't remember now about that. But his letter said that he was anxious and ambitious to become a journalist, and would I send him a letter of introduction to some St. Louis newspaper and make an effort to get him a place as a reporter. It was the first time I had had an opportunity to make a new trial of my great scheme. I wrote him and said I would get him a place on any newspaper in St. Louis. He could choose the one he preferred, but he must promise me to faithfully follow out the instructions which I should give him. He replied that he would follow out those instructions to the letter and with enthusiasm. His letter was overflowing with gratitude, premature gratitude. He asked for the instructions. I sent them. I said he must not use a letter of introduction from me or from anyone else. He must go to the newspaper of his choice and say that he was idle, and weary of being idle, and wanted work, that he was pining for work, longing for work, that he didn't care for wages, didn't want wages, but would support himself. He wanted work, nothing but work, and not work of a particular kind, but any kind of work they would give him to do. He would sweep out the editorial rooms. He would keep the inkstands full, and the mucilage bottles. He would run errands. He would make himself useful in every way he could. I suspected that my scheme would not work with everybody, that some people would scorn to labor for nothing and would think it matter for self-contempt. Also that many persons would think me a fool to suggest such a project. Also that many persons would not have character enough to go into the scheme in a determined way and test it. I was interested to know what kind of a candidate this one was, but of course I had to wait some time to find out. I had told him he must never ask for wages. He must never be beguiled into making that mistake. That sooner or later an offer of wages would come from somewhere, and in that case he must go straight to his employer and give him the opportunity to offer him the like wages, in which case he must stay where he was. That as long as he was in anybody's employ, he must never ask for an advance of wages. That would always come from somewhere else if he proved his worthiness. The scheme worked again. That young fellow chose his paper, and during the first few days he did the sweeping out and other humble work, and kept his mouth shut. After that, the staff began to take notice of him. They saw that they could employ him in lots of ways that saved time and effort for them at no expense. They found that he was alert and willing. They began presently to widen his usefulness. Then he ventured to risk another detail of my instructions. I had told him not to be in a hurry about it, but to make his popularity secure first. He took up that detail now. When he was on his road between office and home, and when he was out on errands, he kept his eyes open, and whenever he saw anything that could be useful in the local columns, he wrote it out, then went over it and abolished adjectives, went over it again and extinguished other surplusages, and finally, when he got it boiled down to the plain facts with the ruffles and other embroideries all gone, he laid it on the city editor's desk. He scored several successes and saw his stuff go into the paper unpruned. Presently, the city editor, when short of help, sent him out on an assignment. He did his best with it, and with good results. This happened with more and more frequency. It brought him into contact with all the reporters of all the newspapers. He made friends with them, and presently one of them told him of a berth that was vacant, and that he could get it and the wages, too. He said he must see his own employers first about it. In strict accordance with my instructions, he carried the offer to his own employers, and the thing happened which was to be expected. They said they could pay that wage as well as any other newspaper, stay where he was. This young man wrote to me two or three times a year, and he always had something freshly encouraging to report about my scheme. Now and then he would be offered a raise by another newspaper. He carried the news to his own paper. His own paper stood the raise every time, and he remained there. Finally he got an offer which his employers could not meet, and then they parted. This offer was a salary of $3,000 a year to be managing editor on a daily in a southern city of considerable importance, and it was a large wage for that day and region. He held that post 3 years. After that, I never heard of him any more. About 1886, my nephew, Samuel E. Moffat, the youth in the 20s, lost his inherited property and found himself obliged to hunt for something to do by way of making a living. He was an extraordinary young fellow in several ways. A nervous malady had early unfitted him for attending school in any regular way, and he had come up without a school education. But this was no great harm for him, for he had a prodigious memory and a powerful thirst for knowledge. At 12 years he had picked up, through reading and listening, a large and varied treasury of knowledge, and I remember one exhibition of it which was very offensive to me. He was visiting in our house, and I was trying to build a game out of historical facts drawn from all the ages. I had put in a good deal of labor on this game, and it was hard labor, for the facts were not in my head. I had to dig them painfully out of the books. The boy looked over my work, found that my facts were not accurate, and the game, as it stood, not usable. Then he sat down and built the whole game out of his memory. To me it was a wonderful performance, and I was deeply offended. As I have said, he wrote me from San Francisco in his early 20s and said he wanted to become a journalist, and would I send him some letters of introduction to the newspaper editors of that city. I wrote back and put him strictly under those same old instructions. I sent him no letter of introduction and forbade him to use one furnished by anybody else. He followed the instructions strictly. He went to work in the Examiner, a property of William R. Hearst. He cleaned out the editorial rooms and carried on the customary drudgeries required by my scheme. In a little while he was on the editorial staff at a good salary. After 2 or 3 years the salary was raised to a very good figure indeed. After another year or two he handed in his resignation, for in the meantime he had married and was living in Oakland or one of those suburbs, and did not like the travel to and fro between the newspaper and his home in the late hours of the night and the morning. Then he was told to stay in Oakland, write his editorials there and send them over, and the large salary was continued. By and by he was brought to New York to serve on Mr. Hearst's New York paper, and when he finally resigned from that employment he had been in Mr. Hearst's employ 16 years without a break. Then he became an editorial writer on the New York World, with the privilege of living out of town and sending his matter in. His wage was $8,000 a year. A couple of years ago, Collier's Weekly offered him an easy berth, and one which was particularly desirable in his case, since it would deal mainly with historical matters, past and present. And that was an industry which he liked. The salary was to be $10,000. He came to me for advice, and I told him to accept, which he did. When Mr. Pulitzer found that he was gone from the World, he was not pleased with his managing editor for letting him go. But his managing editor was not to blame. He didn't know that Moffat was going until he received his resignation. Pulitzer offered Moffat a billet for 20 years, this term to be secured in such a way that it could not be endangered by Pulitzer's death. And to this offer was added the extraordinary proposition that Moffat could name his own salary. But of course Moffat remains with Collier, his agreement with Collier's having been already arrived at satisfactorily to both parties.